There's blood on the ground. Police car lights strobe blue and red over the crime scene, turning tragedy into a discotheque. You only get past the fluttering police tape if you have a badge. Unless that's you on the ground, being traced with chalk. At least that's how it is on TV, but even though this is radio, there's still going to be blood. Lots of blood. Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best of public radio from NPR, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. Today we're going to the scenes of the crime, different kinds, from the ones that take place out in the streets, to inside your homes, to the ones just inside your head. My name's Jake Warga. I'll be your lead investigator for this Hearing Voices hour. And in the second half of the show, it'll be my blood on the ground. Let's start at the beginning of the crime scene, or the idea of the noir crime scene, made popular by one Ouija.
Let me see now. Oh, yeah. My real name is Arthur Felig, but nobody knows me by that. It's Ouija.
With a 1938 Chevy, police radio cigar, and a speed graphic camera, New York's crime scenes were briefly flashed and were forever burned into the pages of history.
I was named right after the Ouija board. I used to spell it O-U-I-J-A, but I changed it to W-E-E-G-E-E to make it easier for the fan mail. All my life, out on all the streets, I know them all because I drive all night long. I know every block, every signpost, every cop, every beggar, everything. I can sense it. I hover around the neighborhood knowing something is going to happen. And I don't know what, but I'm all ready with my camera. Sometimes I cry, I mean, but I figure it's my job to record these things. The same like the cops, firemen, and ambulance driver arrive on the scene, I'm there too. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, if I arrive at a fire after the fire engines do, I feel disgraced and hurt. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I had nothing to do, so I went down to Chinatown, right in the heart of Chinatown. I aimed my camera, and the two cops looked at me, and they hollered over from across the street, "Why waste the film on us?" Well, you won't believe it, this when I tell you. The whole street blew up because the gas main caught fire. I just had nothing to do. It was a nice morning, you know what I mean, and it had been too quiet. I used to sleep in Bryant Park not so many years ago. That was in the summertime, of course. 6 o'clock in the morning, a cop would come around, hit the sole of your shoe with a club. Then I'd get up and I'd go looking for a job. I always loved photography, but I couldn't get no work. That was during the days of the Depression and so forth. And I started hanging around police headquarters at the teletype desk and took pictures. I had no business there because you're supposed to have a press card. But I did it for 2 years on my nerve. And then after I got a little bit known, the editors of the different newspapers that I sold my pictures to helped me get a press card. Look through the wirefinder on my camera, and as a matter of fact, when I really see the picture is when I've developed the film. I really seem to be in a trance when I'm taking a picture. I mean, you just can't hide it. I mean, I'll go around wearing rose-colored glasses. In other words, we have beauty, we have ugliness. Everybody likes beauty, but there's that ugliness. When people look at these pictures of people sleeping on a fire escape and kids and little girls holding cats, they just won't believe a thing like that has happened.
That was a 1945 radio interview from the archives of the Library of Congress, came to us from Sound Portraits.
Hey, wait a minute. Hold on. You hear that?
Yeah, the police car.
Look down the street. There it is. It's coming this way, too.
Something must be up there really traveling. Hey, it's stopping here.
Now that the stage was set, gangsters and the dead knew their places. A whole new genre of American gumshoe radio detectives came on the air.
I got a call to get down here to the Blue Note, and fast.
Well, maybe the criminal's still in there.
Let Logan go first, Danny.
Yeah, I'll get my gun ready.
One inspired series started in 1943, lasting until 1955.
This is Ken Roberts, inviting you to listen to another adventure of Casey, crime photographer. Ace cameraman who covers the crime news of a great city. Our adventure for tonight, Bad Little Babe.
Thank you.
night. In his rather untidy bachelor apartment, Casey slumps comfortably in an ancient, overstuffed chair, reading a popular mystery story.
Now, hello.
Mr. Casey?
Yeah?
What time do you go to work tonight?
Well, 12 o'clock. I'm on the lobster shift this week. Who is it?
Then in about half an hour from now, you'll start walking toward the garage where you keep your car.
Yeah?
Don't do it.
Don't?
If you do, you'll be killed.
Huh?
Killed, I said. Men are watching your apartment house now, waiting for you to come out. Call the police and tell them to get those men.
Wait a minute, who are you?
Never mind that. Phone the police and don't leave.
Now, look here.
I can't talk anymore. Goodbye.
Oh, nuts. It's just a gag.
Homicide Bureau, Captain Logan.
This is Casey, pal.
Oh?
Say, look, I'm probably wasting your time, pal, but I just got a screwy phone call that might be on the level.
Screwy phone call?
Yeah, now, if this turns out to be somebody's idea of a practical joke, I know how you'll use the needle, Logan, but a gal just phoned me. I didn't recognize her voice, and she wouldn't give her name, but here's what she said.
Whoever the gal was who phoned you, Casey, I don't think she was a practical joker.
No?
Now, before I sneaked up here to your apartment by the back way, Sergeant Brett and I spotted a car parked up your block with two guys in it who registered as Red Hots, all right.
Why should they be laying for me?
You're always sticking your neck out, aren't you? If you'd stick to press photography...
Oh, nuts, Logan. I'm no different from any other newspaper guy on a crime beat. And I haven't been sticking my neck out lately.
That remains to be seen. And we'll see when we land those mugs with the goods.
Well, how are you going to do that little thing?
Now, by the time you leave this joint, the street will be completely covered by cops. Now, you walk out of this building alone and start towards your garage. Sergeant Brett will instruct his men not to act until they see you definitely threatened.
Definitely threatened?
When and if the birds in that car or anybody on the street flash guns, the cops will close in.
Yeah, I suppose they're there just a little too late on that close-in. Then I'll be the late Mr. Casey, I suppose.
I'm hoping that won't happen, pal.
Oh, you're hoping?
Sure I am. Oh, put on your hat and coat, Casey. We mustn't keep your would-be killers waiting.
At the scene of the crime, you're tuned to Hearing Voices. To hear the rest of this exciting episode of Casey, Crime Photographer, and other old-time radio stories featured this hour, visit our website, hearingvoices.com.
Now, just when I'm about to find out who done it.
Now here's a sample of a real detective, Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe.
Sounded good, real good. A weekend at Malibu, expenses paid with a cash bonus thrown in. But that was before I knew about the henchman, the redhead, and the corpse. These three and a white Panama hat ruined it all for me.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of crime fiction, comes his most famous character as CBS presents... The Adventures of Philip Marlowe.
I was sitting in my office bombing the ashtray on my desk with paper clips, wondering what kind of a job a private detective gets when clients stop calling completely. I was seesawing between the picture of me as a well-starched huckster and the more comfortable portrait of Marlowe, author in English tweeds, man of distinction, when the telephone brought me to a rude awakening. Marlowe speaking.
My name is Isabel Gordon, Mr. Marlowe. I must see you at once. My husband Bruce is in terrible danger. Could you possibly meet me in an hour at the Pelican Inn? It's a small roadside place on the way to Malibu. I'll explain everything then.
Pelican Inn, 1 hour, Mrs. Gordon. The Pelican Inn was strictly a liquor license with chairs, and a bored piano player in one corner grinding away. The place was empty, and I was about to order a drink when the front door opened and a woman entered. She was tall and thin and right out of Harper's Bazaar, from double-ankle-strap shoes to close-cropped hair. One look at her fear-crowded eyes, and I knew it was Isabel Gordon. I got up and introduced myself. Then we went to a table, and she started to talk.
For 2 weeks now, Mr. Marlowe, my husband Bruce has been receiving unsigned, threatening letters. I'm almost sick with worry. I don't know what to do.
Now, wait a minute, Mrs. Gordon. The first thing to do is to get hold of yourself and tell me the whole thing right from the beginning.
Yes, all right. Well, first of all, Bruce and I have only been married a little more than a year.
We're living with my uncle, Avery Fairchild, on an estate out beyond Malibu.
I see.
At the scene of the crime, you're tuned to Hearing Voices from NPR. Some crime scenes are too hideous to describe, but that's not going to stop us.
Other drivers stare at Neil Smithers' truck and sometimes take pictures. On the sides and back of it, in big red letters, is the company name, Crime Scene Cleaners, specializing in homicides, suicides, and accidental deaths.
Producer Nancy Updike brings us a portrait of one man whose job it is to clean up a crime scene once the cops have stopped taking photos and removed their yellow tape.
After spending 2 days with Neil Smither, I was this close to signing up to open his Los Angeles franchise. I'm not joking. Neil spends all day, every day, speeding around in a huge white pickup truck with a cell phone glued to his ear, making sure his company gets to dispose of every drop of blood within driving distance of Arinda, California, and his franchises in Utah, Kansas, Texas, Las Vegas, and Alabama. Mostly, he doesn't leave the truck. He's had this one for about a year, and it's got 90,000 miles on it. Neil is absolutely blunt about his job, to the point of crassness.
I did a job one time. An old guy dropped dead, decomposed on his kitchen floor. So when we got there, we had about a 10 by 5 foot square pool of just gore. No power in the house, so it's dark, it's very quiet. I'm in there with a respirator because it was just humming, it smelled. Hearing this noise, you know, and I shouldn't be hearing a noise. There's no power in this house, nothing. I got a flashlight. I'm hearing this funky noise, man. What the f*** is that? So I get closer to Gore with my light, and it's just a bowling ball size thing of maggots, and they're writhing around in the blood and the gore, and it sounds like when you knead hamburger.
The maggots were making a sound that you could hear?
So many of them, just so many of them writhing around in this pool of gore that, yeah, you could hear them.
The only time he speaks gently about what he does is on sales calls.
Hi there, this is Neil. May I help you? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All righty. That's all you need to tell me. Let me kind of walk you through how we work. We'd have a crew to you within the hour. They'd write you up a free estimate. If you like the estimate, they'd rock and roll on that job right then and there. Our services are all in.
By the way, have you noticed Neil's southern accent? He made it up. He borrowed it from his Arkansas grandparents so he could play Steel Magnolia during business negotiations. He grew up in Santa Cruz. He has no problem admitting the accent is cultivated.
Something about a southern voice that just kind of opens up a trusting vein, you know? Which is great. I mean, that's what I want.
Neil has that tightly wound energy like Jim Carrey. He's 5'5", with short brown hair under a baseball cap and sunglasses. He smokes Cools, does not stop for lunch, and drives way too fast. The directness, the crassness, is all deliberate. It's his marketing strategy.
Gore sells. Look at the truck. We're pretty upfront. I hope I don't offend too many people. I try to be honest with them, you know? I mean, we're dealing with death. How do you sugarcoat death? You know? You can't.
Neil describes for me the outline left on a pleather couch by a body that has decomposed into it over the course of 60 days. And I want to stop here and acknowledge that this is gross. It is. It's gross. But it's interesting. And to me, it's much more interesting than it is gross. I mean, think of it. A melted person. Four years ago, Neil had never seen a dead body. He was a laid-off mortgage broker, for God's sake. Then he saw Pulp Fiction. Remember that scene where John Travolta blows the guy's head off in the back of the car by mistake, and they have to call in Mr. Wolf to fix everything?
I need you two fellas to do is take those cleaning products and clean the inside of the car. You need to go in the back seat, scoop up all those little pieces of brain and skull. Get it out of there.
Neil is possibly the only person in America who saw that scene and thought, wow, I want that job. And it turns out it is a real job. If someone dies in your house, it's up to you to get it clean. But doing it yourself, even if you wanted to, raises all sorts of problems. Are you complying with the state and federal laws governing the disposal of bodies and bodily fluids? Do you have the proper permits and liability coverage? No, you don't. So you call Neil. Here's how his job breaks down. Murders are the least of his business. Most of the cleanups are either decomps, bodies that have sat for a while and started to decompose.
I did a decomp on the very end unit upstairs there. It was bad.
How long had it been going?
He sat for a good long while. He was all humming. Maggots everywhere. It's a typical decomp.
Or suicides. Suicides and attempted suicides are a surprisingly big part of his job. The rest of Neil's business consists of meth labs and kitty houses. Kitty houses are those places, usually full of old newspapers and other garbage, that have dozens of cats everywhere, eating and peeing and crapping. Meth labs are usually hotel accounts. Neil has a few national chains on contract. Hotel rooms get used all the time to cook methamphetamine, Neil says. He does a lot of business with hotels. He claims, hyperbolically, that there's no hotel in the country that hasn't had a murder or suicide in one of its rooms. The second day I spend with Neil, he gets called out to a jail to clean up after a woman who tried to kill herself in the bathroom off the prisoner's waiting room. I'm not allowed to record anything. I have to just watch. I hold open the bathroom door with my foot while Neil sets up his stuff. Next to the sink are several thick, dark red drops of blood, and there are a few streaks of blood on the wall. Inside the sink is more blood. It isn't a lot, maybe a third of a cup overall. But clearly she did some damage. Then, while Neil is getting into his protective suit, a woman in the waiting room behind us, a tweaker, Neil confided to me later, meaning a meth user, reads the back of Neil's shirt out loud. "Crime scene cleaners," she says. "You cleaned my mother's house." Neil turns around. "Yeah? Which one was that?" Without any emotion, the woman says her mother and cousin were murdered by her mother's boyfriend a while ago. "You guys cleaned the house," she repeats. "Oh yeah, I remember that one. That was on the news," Neil says. The woman nods and doesn't say anything. So Neil goes back to cleaning. He whips through it in about 10 minutes, like it's spilt milk. In fact, it's exactly like cleaning up a mess at home, except with industrial-strength cleansers and equipment. He snaps on some rubber gloves, sprays the whole area with a special enzyme to neutralize the blood and kill any bacteria or viruses, scrubs any tough spots with a little brush, and then wipes everything clean with heavy-duty paper towels. It isn't hard, just depressing.
Bottom line, I'm a businessman. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to make money and build my company.
Were you like this as a kid?
Well, I was the kid in school who would buy boxes of blow pops and bring them to school and sell them at lunch. You know, I was a kid at school who ran a lunch ticket scam. You know,
what was the lunch ticket scam?
I had a girlfriend in the office, you know, the head office in high school, and she'd kick me down with lunch tickets for a discounted price, and then I'd sell them for an increased price, but it was still lower than what the, you know, the Mexican kids or whoever could buy them from the school. So I figure I beat the school by 20 cents a ticket. I bankrolled my whole high school career on blow pops and lunch tickets. It was a beautiful thing. I always had money, and I didn't break any laws. Didn't sling dope. None of that. Bought my own car, and I bankrolled it with blow pops and lunch tickets.
Neil's plan is to retire in 7 years at 40 and be rich. But in the meantime, the job is changing him. Seeing so many crime scenes, seeing the way so many people die, he's also seen how they live in houses filled with old newspapers, dirty dishes, and too many cats, never cleaning the bathroom.
I think more than anything now, most people are just dirty mother. We live like animals, man. You have no idea. I'm a clean freak. My place is spotless. You know, so when I got into this, I was shocked by the way people live. And it's amazing. I went into a bathroom yesterday at a car wash, right? Guy in there doing his business. And I walk into the thing and, you know, this guy had thrown his garbage on the floor and didn't flush the toilet. Just common, you know, No common courtesy at all. You know? And he was in a tie and a you know, a clean-cut, nice-looking guy. You know? Didn't your mom teach you anything? You know, you 40-year-old dirtbag. You know? Are you just a dirtbag? That's dirtbag. Straight up. That is a dirtbag.
Did you think people were big dirtbags before this job?
I had no idea. I had no idea. I thought, you know, everyone was normal. You know, believe me, it's the normal is the dirtbagginess.
But now you see more dirtbaggery everywhere?
Oh, it's 80-20 dirtbag. You bet. I swear to God. It's shocking. So now I'll go home and take a hot shower. Then I'll convert to a bathtub, read my book, and not think about dirtbags. Wait for my girl to get home. Wait for death. Death or my girl, I love them both.
Neil's thought a lot about his own death in the last few years, not surprisingly. He says he wants to die slowly so he can say goodbye to everyone. He doesn't want to be found by a company like his and cleaned up with his family off somewhere wondering what happened. He doesn't even care if it's a painful death, he says, as long as it's slow. Cancer would be fine, he says. He'd take cancer. When was the last time you heard someone say that?
Why don't we listen to a little music from Herman Chittison? It's all yours, Herman.
That was producer Nancy Updike of This American Life. Coming up, a personal story of a violent mugging. A warning, there will be blood. My blood, and lots of it. You're visiting Crime Scenes with Hearing Voices from NPR.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Scene of the Crime from Hearing Voices. I'm your host, Jake Warga. Crime scenes don't always feature chalk outlines, guns, or blood. Sometimes criminals leave a paper trail. Reporter Adam Allington brings us a story about a white-collar criminal.
For someone who used to crave the limelight, these days Mark Moores lives about as far away from the action as one can get. His new residence is in Boron, California, a tiny town in the middle of the Mojave Desert that takes its name from the nearby borax mines. Across the street from Mark's apartment, a freight on the Santa Fe Railway is the only sound for miles around. I don't know what I was expecting when I drove up from L.A. to meet Mark, but I can tell you I was not prepared for the former UCLA linebacker standing shirtless waiting for me in the parking lot of the Desert Lake Hotel.
This is the high desert where you see nothing but yucca trees and scrub, and we're standing outside now, and you could easily get a good, great sunburn, and this is a cool day. This is a very cool day for here. It's usually many, many degrees hotter than this. I have a small apartment here in Boron, and in the living room of my apartment, I have two big pieces of exercise equipment. One's built by Nautilus, which is a free weight system.
Back in the comparative cool of Mark's apartment, he offers me a Pepsi and tells me the story of how he saw his net worth skyrocket from a modest middle-class income to over $50 million in just 2 years. He had 14 cars, 4 homes, and he spent his weekends comped at some of Las Vegas's most elite casinos. And the muscle behind this sea of cash wasn't technology or manufacturing. It was carpet.
That's so much money. It seems so unbelievable. Did you ever just lean back in your chair and just go, whew.
Well, yes, I would lean back in my chair on the private jet flying into Vegas, knowing I was going to be staying in an 8-bedroom suite at Caesar's Palace. But you start thinking, there's so much around you, there's so much money, and there's so much reality. No one will ever let this thing fall apart. And I couldn't have been more wrong. But you do sit back and think to yourself, you know, I just spent $55,000 on a watch. Business is very simple. It's not easy. Once you understand people's greed, you have half the equation. You've got the buyer's equation.
If you're tired of going through the same problems every time you want your carpets cleaned, it's time you called us. I'm Barry Minko, president of Z-Best Carpet Cleaning. We clean carpets with such...
Mark says that the real shame about the Z-Best fraud was that it never had to happen. The legitimate part of the company was doing quite well, and had they not been so unbelievably greedy, they would still have become rich men. But they lived dangerously, and when they were finally exposed, there was no plea bargain to be made. Mark was convicted of stock fraud, wire fraud, and tax evasion, and sentenced to 8 years in a federal prison.
That first night in jail in lockdown with all of the other people, all the clanging of locked doors behind you, the black and blue marks from the handcuffs, the little steps you have to take because your feet are handcuffed together, and suddenly you realize this isn't just for a few days or hours. This is going to be months and years, even if I make parole. It was the harshest, scariest slap I could ever imagine. I still didn't feel like a, quote, criminal. I somehow felt we were different. And I started noticing every white-collar guy I did talk to began every sentence with, well, all I did was, and then you fill in the blank. Once you're there and you start feeling the animosity the other prisoners have toward white-collar guys, where they look at it and go, they say to you, you're no different than us. You're just a thief. You use other words. Even the word embezzlement's a nice word. You're a thief. They said, you lie to people and take their money. That's what I do, too. And that hit me like a ton of bricks.
Imagine going from your home in Malibu one day to a prison cell the next. And not just for a few days or weeks, but years. This is a hard pill for white-collar guys to swallow. For Mark, the first step was completely accepting this guilt, owning up to the lies, admitting that he was a thief. He says that after that, at least he could do his time, knowing that he was in jail for a reason, that there was no one else to blame but himself.
Thank you all for showing up. It's a heck of a crowd. My name is Mark Morris. I'm 45 years old. I kind of want to put a human face on stock fraud and...
After Mark got out of jail in the 1990s, he began the next phase of his quest to own up. These days, he goes around the country talking about his experience, trying to help other people avoid ending up in the same place he did.
To teach you how to commit a fraud, even though if you took careful notes, you probably could do a pretty good one.
He speaks to MBA classes, executives, CPAs. During these talks, he tells the audience that he's not trying to scare them. But to me, he admits that actually, he is trying to scare them a little. That way, when the temptation arises to fudge the books, maybe they'll think of him.
While I was in prison, I witnessed at least 70 or 80 major assaults. Dozens of rapes. I've never been able to capture that when I talk to people in doing my lectures, but I can say this, because they all want to believe this myth that white-collar guys go to Camp Fluffy. Well, that's a myth. Nothing could be more wrong.
Sometimes during these talks, people stand up and confront Mark, call him a liar. Why should they believe a criminal like him? It doesn't bother him. Of course, he wants people to like him. But he's not trying to convince them that he's a nice guy. Much more important is for them to see his ethical shortfalls in themselves.
White-collar guys, since we don't put a gun in your face, we don't think we're bad guys. But what people have to realize is that by just placing a zero where it doesn't belong, that changes an investment of $8 million to $80 million. One little zero. And almost every white-collar criminal has that rationale where you go, I'm going to fix this. I'm only going to do it once. It's a little thing. And nobody gets hurt. And suddenly everybody wakes up one morning and goes, I'm out of a job. I thought, honey, I thought I was going to have a job for life with Enron. What happened? And it all happened because a selfish jerk like me made that one decision and said that line, well, nobody gets hurt.
That was White Collar Crime, brought to us by Adam Allington.
Fatima Cigarettes, best of all long cigarettes, brings you Dragnet.
You're listening to Scene of the Crime from Hearing Voices. We're paying homage to radio crime scenes this hour, past and present.
You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned a homicide detail. A socially prominent citizen is plotting to kill his wife. He tells you his plans for the murder. He hires you to do the killing. Your job, stop him.
From 1949 till it went to television in 1957, Dragnet on NBC starred Jack Webb as Detective Joe Friday, who brought real and authentic as possible horrors to the radio.
For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department,
transforming living rooms across the country into crime scenes for half an hour. That is, after the kids went to bed. Based on real police case files, the show was a hit. Think Law and Order. Earlier this year, I was violently mugged. Here's my story.
The story you are about to hear is true.
So this is the famous Harborview County Hospital. The only view I have is of ceilings. Ceilings of the ambulance, a bored EMT coming in and out of frame. Ceiling of the ER waiting room. I can hear the sounds of people in unfortunate times. Coughing, crying, kids, boredom, waiting. I get priority. A nurse comes into view. Sign here. I authorize treatment. I make a scribble, an imitation of my signature. A bit of blood smears next to it, making it official. She disappears. It's back to acoustic paneling and fluorescent lights. My pediatrician had a smiley face sticker on his ceiling. I feel frowning faces all around me. I cannot turn my head. They put a brace around my neck, but then it hurts too much to turn anyways. Yo, can I use your phone? Supposed to meet up with my friend. Daylight for Seattle, overcast for anywhere else. I had been using my laptop in the park. I was marked from the start. Worried at first, but they're just kids in hoodies now that I see them up close. Witnesses will later say they were 20 years old. I say closer to 15. What hospital would you like to go to? Asked one of the blue uniforms circling me. A policeman, EMTs, firemen, all in blue. A ladder truck blocks the street, big, red, like in kids' picture books. I was not mugged in a tree. I was not. I was not mugged on top of a tall building. I was not. I do not like being mugged. I do not. Why did they send a ladder truck? Ask. I do not. I point up the hill. There's a hospital a few blocks away. I thought ambulance drivers knew these things, like how a cab driver knows where the nearest airport is. Unless you have group health, it's kind of hard to get into, says one man in blue. I used to volunteer there, wearing a red blazer, manning the information desk, pointing patients where to go and be patient, or wheeling them around if they were impatient. I'm losing my patience. Why don't you take me somewhere that will stop the bleeding? I wince as another in blue gloves and blue uniform tries to remove the blue dress shirt I'm holding in a roll over my head. I wonder if that's a good idea. I hear a gasp or tisk, not sure which or where it came from, if it didn't come from me. A gauze is wrapped around my head. Now I'm a bloody cartoon of a jaw ache. More panels and fluorescent lights. The foot of my narrow bed with wheels crashes through double doors, just like on TV, but without the stereo soundtrack. I'm parked in trauma, backed into an array of machines. Hands are all over me. I do not get any phone numbers. I fuse with the machines, sensors stuck on random, at least to me, places on my chest, and one on my tummy. I want to ask what that one's for, but really, I don't want to know. My jaw hurts. Did they hit me there, too? The beeping starts. I start the machines beeping. A red light is taped around one of my fingers. It's an oxygen sensor. I know this from experience. An IV line is inserted. I tell the doctor I'm O negative, but I didn't think I lost that much blood. She says it's procedure to put on an IV. I don't need blood. I know not to question wisdom of procedure. So now man and machine are one. The flashlight and the eye thing, both sides of the brain working. The thing in the ear to look for bleeding, or worse, other fluids. My ears are filled with blood, I can feel that, but it's not blood from my ears. Push against me, she says, holding my wrist back. Good. Now raise your leg. I do. I try. She's pressing against it. So how's about the head, I want to ask. Ceiling of the X-ray room, dark, cold, really cold. I'm directly under an AC vent. I can see this. It's all I can see. Keeps the equipment cold, a technician tells me. It does, I tell her. My bloody T-shirt was cut off, very dramatic. I lay still as a crosshair of light targets me 6 different times and angles. The CT scanner room is warmer, plus I'm given heated blankets. I fear the bill. A voice through a speaker says to be still. The bed inches me into the scanner. Parts inside the scanner and me twirl around. Can they read my thoughts? Can they see the faces of the 2 kids? Black. Not good at making eye contact. The dodgy eyes of liars. The scans are worth it. The neck brace comes off. I hand my phone to a bystander, standing by after dialing George. Can you tell my friend George I can't make it for dinner tonight? She looks stunned. They all look stunned. She does this for me. I ask another, I'm sorry, in my bag there's an eyeglass case. I take off my glasses. Sure thing, yeah, okay, eyeglass case. Why is everyone so nervous? They should be relieved it's not them sitting on the ground bleeding from the head, fighting off the urge to sleep. About a year ago, just a few blocks up the same street, a woman was murdered. I try not to think about this, but I don't have complete control of my thoughts. The case is found. I retire my glasses. One lens has blood running down it. I will photograph it later. It will remind me of John Lennon. I was taught that you never hit someone with glasses. I was taught that you never hit someone. I was taught. I rest my head on my backpack that, until quite recently, held a laptop. The girl told George what happened. I thank her. A bloody hand reaches out and takes the phone back. I've never seen so much blood on my own hand. I've never seen so much blood. The cop in blue holds out a Ziploc bag and asks me to drop the phone in it, for prints. It's no longer mine. I tell him they made a call. Check the calls. I realize later they didn't make any calls. They were just pretending to lead me away from the park, from witnesses. Patient from Alaska, 30 minutes out, say speakers through the ER. Speakers on the ceiling, I can see them. I wonder about a stain on the ceiling directly above me, a splatter of something. Only patients see these things. I try not to think about it. Who's come in before me? Who has not left before me? Wow, what happened to the guy from Alaska? I ask the doctor, who's sewing the first of 6 stitches on the top of my head. She's tired. She has a cold. I will get a cold. That's how it works. I can't tell you. Patient confidentiality. We will learn a lot in 30 minutes about the patient from Alaska. Curtains do not stop sound. What's slowly occurring to me is that what should be occurring to me is only very slowly occurring to me. I realize I've been struck hard on the head only because I fail to realize I've been struck on the head. One moment the kid's handing me my phone after I became suspicious and demanded its return, my back to his partners. To list the mistakes I made here would be too long. Then he's upside down, then right side up. How odd. This is not a good time to sleep, I tell myself. Still, I fall into a nightmare. Keeping me awake, partially, is the sound of someone who sounds like me yelling for help. I move in slow motion. Why does time warp in a tragedy? In my dream, I try to kick one of them in the crotch, but his pants are too baggy. So that's why they wear them like that. Clever. I do not want to fight. I fear, slowly of course, they may still have a weapon. Then I fall. I will not realize this till the next day, when George's baby girl, holding onto my leg for walking support, decides to chomp on my knee. How cute. Ouch. She barely has teeth. I roll up my pants after shooing her along. Sure enough, there are scars on my knees, so that's when I fell to the ground. Patient from Alaska arrived, speaks the speaker above me. That's one consolation of being in hospitals. There are always people worse off. The doctor excuses herself as a fleet of people roll in. A curtain is closed, but the act has just begun. Mr. Alaska was found at the base of a ladder, does not remember falling off. I know his name, how can I not, but I won't share it. Patient confidentiality. I feel for him. People go to Alaska to be left alone. Now he's sitting in the lower 48. Collarbone broken, they go on with the stats. He doesn't seem that bad off. Mr. Alaska sounds old, not terribly bright, but that could be the drugs. Why is he even conscious? The latter is the contemporary predator of our species. Now we'll learn later from the nurse when we get to talking about all the reasons people enter this tragic theater. Never sit in a bar stool with no back, that's all I'm saying. The flight crew that brought Mr. Alaska in, everyone, for that matter, double takes as they exit past me. Maybe because I have a new hole in my head, I can hear their thoughts. Wow, what happened to him? I'm caked in my own blood, sitting up now, stitched, wondering why I don't get drugs. I do what most people do in hospitals, wait, patiently, hence our names. Mr. Alaska, can you press against my arm? Asked my former doctor, repeating the familiar exercises. He's a bit of an anticlimax. The speakers promise more urgency, tragedy, and pensive music. Is there any history of heart disease in your family, Mr. Alaska? The doctor blubbers through the mucus of her cold. Well, yes, come to think of it, my wife's father had to have a bypass. My head hurts too much to roll my eyes, hurts way too much to laugh. My monitors beep faster. I can hear an eye roll in the doctor's voice. In your family. Our healthcare system is defeating natural selection. If I may offer only one bit of advice, it's not about not trusting people, not about being kind, not about using expensive silver shiny things in public. None of that, no. My advice would be do not have a large mocha before being whisked away to an emergency room. A nurse enters my curtain space. Free of the neck brace, I'm not free of the bed and the connections to the machines. 35 years, I say out loud to everyone and no one. She looks at my head before looking at the papers. Bike accident? She asks. No, mugging. Ouch. Yes, ouch. I've made it 35 years without having to go to a hospital for myself. No broken bones, no accidents, no intentionals. Surely she knows the pathetic, pleading look of a patient who has to pee. But I must explain it to her. A cup with a handle is hooked to the bed rail. Unless you need a sample, I tell her, I think I can hold it. Do you want a bedpan? She says, deadpanned. Not for another 35 years, I tell her. These words are a knee-jerk reaction. We are human, and as humans, we have something remarkable in common. When a little hammer taps our knee, a signal is sent to the brain. What it does with this information seems odd, but the signal in reply causes the stricken leg to leap a little. Fun as a kid, fascinating in physiology class, absent when something goes horribly wrong. Hitting a writer on the head should cause them to write. I scribble thoughts in my notepad. These are them. Things on the inside are still working, for I am writing. It is a reflex. I am sorry. Black and white. These letters, like the kids on me, read as irony, not racism. I am recovering. This is recovery. My bleeding words. I'm locked in my bedroom, in the dark space between hiding and recuperating, trying not to think about the only thing I'm thinking about. I pop Advil like chiclets. I cry. I bawl. It hurts to weep, but it feels better. I curse the world, I curse myself, between how stupid I am and how stupid the world is. I am mortal. This is my curse. This is my reminder. Life is a terminal condition. I don't believe God exists, but if he does, then he's angry at me for something. I borrow cash from George because a few days earlier I was the victim of credit fraud. None of my cards work. But if God exists, I want to thank him, her, for public radio. I tune in to hear first how bad the environment is, how it's my fault. Then people are dying for lack of food in places I'll never visit. It's somehow our fault. People are dying from eating too much in the country I live. It's their fault. There's a fascination with death counts. Cyclone, Maybe our fault. Earthquake. Not our fault line. No names, just numbers dead. Then, a Prairie Home Companion. The weekend-dominating show that normally gives me a headache, but I already have one. A show for the old and or the recovering. Garrison opens with a fart joke. I laugh. It hurts. I listen. I don't want to think. I stare out the window, a prisoner's view. I watch the tree that watched what happened to me. Cherry blossoms drip pink flowers in the shadow where I dripped blood. Dark clouds. It looks like rain. It always looks like rain. My mother rolls in her grave as I eat a cookie in bed. Crumbs dribbling among the sheets. Serves her right for not being here for me, and on Mother's Day. She's one of the reasons I cry. She's not here to soothe me. My father's not here to protect me. The radio is my only company, and I'm lonely. The paramedic shows me my bloody shirt, the one I used to stop the bleeding. Do you want to keep it? I feel the bystanders gazing at the horror of a shirt. Now it's a tie-dye of a crime scene. I buy my clothes at Goodwill. I don't care about it. No, lose it, I tell him. And the hat? Was I wearing a hat? I assume these stupid questions are to keep me conscious, hoping, as a cop asks my name while looking at my driver's license. I am in their blue-gloved hands. They will not touch my blood. George shows up on the scene, for it is a scene, and I play the role of a victim, sitting in the middle of the stage, surrounded by characters in blue. I give him my backpack and house keys. Later, I will toss the backpack, too. I might be able to get the blood caked all over it off, but I cannot erase the memories. If I pass out, I tell one of the people in blue, I want to be cremated, pointing to the funeral home and crematorium in view of my personal crime scene. They laugh. I walk across the park, leaving my bed in search of food. I stay away from the trees and bushes. Children are at play. Parents are holding their hands to their heads in mock agony, talking on their phones. I make it through the park at the other side. My hand is hurting. I look down at it in curiosity. I had been making a fist the whole time. Something strange is happening. It's finally quiet in the ER. No one is coming in, poking me with needles or questions. The curtains are partially closed. I can see into the hallways. There's no mad dashing of people. I am alone. This is not good. The worst thing that can happen in an ER is being given time to really notice you're in an ER. The noises have stopped. The pain in my head is numb, for now. I think about what has happened, what is happening, and start to cry. No, 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 not here, not now. I am strong. I start to see through the blur of tears that I'm not alone. The ghosts of my parents, my grandparents, friends, all whom I have known that are no longer, are standing around my bed now, but not in the frightening way ghosts can do, drifting, silent statues. They are my memories of them, simply standing there. I invited them. They are telling me because I am telling me it's not time. Just a warning, they say, if they could talk. You were lucky. This is your halfway mark. Don't come to a hospital for a long time. The large articulating lamp above me, circa 1950, swings a little on its hinges. The spooks are spooked. They all disappear. I squint my eyes shut. Tears stream down, washing away the blood from my crow's feet. The doctor enters on cue. I cannot stop. It's all hitting me now, only a couple of hours after I was hit. Her hand rests on my shoulder. She does not tell me to press back. I'm so stupid, I tell her. My priest, my physician. This is not victim speech. This is the truth. I was stupid. No, she says. You were trusting. You lent someone your phone. It's okay. That's who you are. Don't change who you are. I want to hug her, but I also want to die. Standing over the remains of my own blood stains on the sidewalk, I rehearse being a ghost. If I were dead, this is where I would be standing or wafting over in a puff of smoke from the crematorium. This is what I would be watching before I go on to whatever it is I go on to doing. Maybe standing next to the bedside of friends in the ER, scaring them into sticking around, repeating the moment over and over. I know I'm alive because I'm not dead, but that's all the proof I have. This makes me sad. I want to love. I want to be loved. I want not to sleep alone. I want to embrace life. I want to sing. Instead, I go back inside my house for a nap in hope I don't dream.
Stop.
Yo, can I use your phone? Supposed to meet up with my friend. Daylight for Seattle. Overcast for anywhere else. I'd been using my laptop in the park. I was marked from the start. Worried at first, but they're just kids in hoodies now that I see them up close. Witnesses will later say they were 20 years old. I say closer to 15. You've been listening to Scene of the Crime from Hearing Voices. This is Where's My Mind, a Pixies cover by Placebo. Other music you heard this hour came from Bell and Sebastian, Alias, and various Kodo drumming artists. For a complete list of music and links to all the stories you heard this hour, visit our website, hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darham. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.